An enormous crowd attended the sage's funeral because during his long life he had helped thousands of persons live in good health and die without agony. Government officials and dignitaries filed by with the greatest solemnity. Literati recited their best poems, and courtesans showed up in their finest silks. A seer determined the most favorable day for the burial, and an artist who crafted funeral offerings visited the house of the deceased to copy his possessions. He went around the property slowly, without taking measurements or notes, although beneath his voluminous sleeves he was making marks in a wax tablet with his fingernail. Later, he constructed paper miniatures of the rooms and furnishings of the house, including the dead man's favorite objects, to be burned with bundles of paper money. He must not in the other world be deprived of the things he had enjoyed in this one. The coffin, which was huge and decorated like an imperial carriage, passed through the streets of the city between two rows of soldiers in dress uniform, preceded by horsemen attired in brilliant colors, and a band of musicians playing cymbals, drums, flutes, bells, triangles, and a variety of stringed instruments. The noise was unbearable, befitting the importance of the deceased. Flowers, clothing, and food were heaped upon his grave. Candles and incense were lighted, and finally the money and quantities of paper objects were burned. The ancestral gold-sheathed tablet, engraved with the master's name, was placed upon the grave to receive his spirit, while the body returned to the earth. It was the role of the eldest son to accept the tablet and install it in a place of honor in his home, beside those of other male ancestors. But the physician had no one to carry out that duty. Dao Qian was only a servant, and it would have been an unforgivable breach of etiquette for him to offer. He was genuinely moved. Among the throng, he was surely the only one whose tears and wailing represented true grief. But the ancestral tablet ended up in the hands of a distant nephew, whose moral obligation it would be to bring offerings and pray before it every 2 weeks and on each anniversary. Once these solemn funeral rites were realized, the creditors fell like jackals upon the master's possessions. They ravaged the sacred texts in the laboratory, pawed through the herbs, spoiled the medicinal preparations, destroyed his carefully crafted poems, carried off his furniture and art objects, trampled the beautiful garden, and auctioned off the ancient mansion. Only shortly before, Dao Qian had safely hidden the gold acupuncture needles, a case containing medicinal instruments and a few essential remedies, and a small amount of money he had been filching for the last 3 years, ever since his master had begun to lose his way in the barren landscape of senile dementia. It was not his intention to steal from the venerable Zhang Yi, whom he revered like a grandfather, but to use the money to feed him, because he saw the debts piling up and feared the future. The suicide had precipitated events, however, and Dao Qian found himself in possession of an unexpected bonanza. Taking those funds could cost him his head, for his would be a crime of inferior against superior, but he was sure that no one would know except the spirit of the deceased, who undoubtedly would have approved his action. Would he not prefer rewarding his faithful servant and disciple to paying one of the many debts he owed to ravenous creditors? With this modest treasure and a change of clean clothing, Dao Qian fled the city. It occurred to him fleetingly to return to the village of his birth, but he immediately discarded that plan. To his family, he would always be fourth son. He would owe submission and obedience to his older brothers. He would have to work for them, accept the wife they chose for him, and resign himself to lifelong poverty. Nothing called him in that direction, not even filial obligations to his father and his ancestors, which fell to his older brothers anyway. What he needed was to go somewhere far away, somewhere the long arm of Chinese justice could not reach. He was 20 years old, and he had 1 year left before he would have fulfilled the 10 years of his servitude, and any one of the creditors could claim the right to use him as a slave for that time. Dao Qian. Dao Qian took a sampan to Hong Kong with the intention of beginning a new life. Now he was a Zhang Yi, trained in traditional Chinese medicine by the finest master in Canton. He owed eternal gratitude to the spirits of his venerable ancestors, who had worked out his karma in such a glorious manner. The first thing he must do, he decided, was take a wife, for he was of an age and more to marry, and celibacy was too heavy a load. The absence of a wife was a sign of poverty that could not be hidden. He cherished the prospect of acquiring a delicate young woman with beautiful feet. Her golden lilies should not be more than 3 or 4 inches long, and should be plump and soft to the touch, like the feet of an infant of a few months. He was fascinated by the way a young girl walked on those minuscule feet, with short, very hesitant steps, as if she were always about to fall, hips thrown back and swaying like the reeds at the edge of the pond in his master's garden. He detested large, muscular, and cold feet, like those of a peasant woman. In his village from afar, he had seen girls with bound feet, the pride of their families, who undoubtedly would marry them well. But only when he visited the prostitutes in Canton had he held 2 of those golden lilies in his hands and swooned in ecstasy over the tiny embroidered slippers that always covered them, necessarily because for years and years the destroyed bones seeped a foul-smelling substance. After he touched such feet, he realized that their elegance was the fruit of constant pain, and that made them even more valuable. Then he properly appreciated the books in his master's collection that were devoted to women's feet, describing the 5 classes and 18 different styles of golden lilies. His wife must also be very young, for beauty lasted but a brief time. It began sometime around the 12th year and ended shortly after the woman reached 20. These things his master had explained to him. It was not for nothing that the most celebrated heroines of Chinese literature always died at the precise moment of their greatest charm. Fortunate were those who departed this world before they were ruined by age and could still be remembered in the fullness of their fresh beauty. There were also practical reasons to prefer a nubile girl. She would give him male children, and it would be easy to tame her nature and make her truly submissive. Nothing as disagreeable as a shrieking woman. He had seen some who spit at their husbands and children and slapped them about, even in the street in front of the neighbors. Such humiliation at the hands of a woman was the worst shame for a man. In the sampan that slowly carried him the 90 miles between Canton and Hong Kong, leaving his past life farther behind by the minute, Dao Qian dreamed of that girl, of the pleasure and the sons she would give him. Again and again he counted the money in his pocket, as if with abstract calculations he could make it grow. But it was clear that it would not stretch far enough for a wife of the quality he desired. Nevertheless, he was not content, however great his urgency, to settle for less and live the rest of his days with a wife who had large feet and a strong character. The island of Hong Kong appeared suddenly before his eyes, with its profile of mountains and green vegetation, emerging like a siren from the indigo waters of the China Sea. As soon as his light boat docked in the port, Dao Qian noted the presence of the despised foreigners. He had seen a few of them before, but at a distance. Now he saw them so near that had he dared, he could have touched them to test whether those huge, graceless creatures were truly human. With amazement, he discovered that many of the Fan Wei had red or yellow hair, pale eyes, and skin the color of boiled lobsters. He thought the women very ugly. They were wearing hats bedecked with feathers and flowers, perhaps trying to cover that diabolical hair. They were dressed in an extraordinary fashion, in stiff clothing that bound their bodies tightly. He supposed that was why they moved like automatons and did not greet each other with friendly bows. They passed by, stiff as poles, not looking at anyone, suffering the summer heat in their uncomfortable clothing. There were 12 European ships in the port, surrounded by thousands of Asian boats of all sizes and colors. In the streets he saw a few carriages driven by uniformed men, lost among the many vehicles propelled by humans. Litters, palanquins, hand barrows, and porters simply carrying their fare on their backs. The smell of fish came like a slap, reminding him that he was hungry. First, he must locate a place to eat, which he would know by its long strips of yellow silk. Dao Qian ate like a prince in a restaurant crowded with people talking and laughing at the tops of their voices, an unmistakable sign of contentment and good digestion, where he savored the delicate dishes that had long been forgotten in the house of his master. that Zhang Yi had been a great gourmet during his lifetime and had prided himself on having had the best cooks in Canton in his service. But during his latter years, he had lived on green tea and rice with a few shreds of vegetables. At the time Dao Chen had escaped his servitude, he was as thin as any of the countless people in Hong Kong who suffered from tuberculosis. This was his first decent meal in a very long time, and the onslaught of tastes, aromas, and textures was ecstasy. He ended the feast with the pleasure of a pipe. He went outside floating and laughing aloud like a madman. He had never felt so filled with enthusiasm and good luck. He breathed in the air about him, so reminiscent of Canton, and decided that it would be easy to conquer that city, just as 9 years earlier he had conquered the other one. First, he would look for the market and the district of the healers and herbalists, where he would find a place to live and offer his professional services. Then he would consider the matter of the woman with the tiny feet. That very afternoon, Dao Chen found lodging in the attic of a large house divided into compartments that housed one family per room, a veritable anthill. His room, a dark tunnel a meter wide by 3 meters long, windowless, dark, and hot, trapped the fumes from the cooking and chamber pots of the other renters, mixed with the unmistakable stench of general filth. Compared to his master's refined home, it was like living in a rat hole, but he remembered that his parents' home had been even poorer. As an unmarried man, he did not need more space or luxury, he decided, only a corner where he could put his pallet and few belongings. Later, when he married, he would look for an appropriate dwelling where he could prepare his medicines, attend his patients, and be served by his wife as was fitting. For the moment, while he established contacts indispensable to his work, this space at least gave him a roof and a bit of privacy. He left his things and went to bathe, shave the front of his skull, and rebraid his queue. As soon as he was presentable, he left to look for a gaming house, determined to double his capital in the least possible time and get started along the path of success. In less than 2 hours at Fantan, Dao Chen lost all his money. He did not lose his medical instruments, only because he had not thought to bring them. The shouting in the gaming hall was so thunderous that bets were made by signaling through the dense tobacco smoke. Fantan was a simple game. It consisted of a handful of counters underneath a cup. Bets were taken, the chips counted out 4 at a time, and the person who guessed how many were left, 1, 2, 3, or none, won. Dao Chen could scarcely follow the hands of the man who threw the chips and counted them. It seemed to him that he had been cheated. But to accuse the banker in public would have been an offense so grave that were he in error, he would have paid with his life. Every day in Canton, the bodies of insolent losers were picked up in the area of the gaming houses. It would be no different in Hong Kong. Dao returned to his tunnel in the attic and threw himself down on his mat and wept like a baby, thinking of the switchings he had received at the hands of his former acupuncture master. His despair lasted until the following morning, when he recognized his impatience and his arrogance with abysmal clarity. Then he burst out laughing, grateful for the lesson, convinced that the mischievous spirit of his master had presented it to teach him something more. He had been awakened in total darkness by the noise of the house and the street. It was late morning, but no natural light reached his hole. Groping in the dark, he put on his only change of clean clothing. He was still laughing as he took his medical kit and set out for the market. In the tattoo artist shops, covered from top to bottom with pieces of cloth and paper, exhibiting their patterns, one could choose from among thousands of designs, from discreet flowers in indigo blue ink to fantastic five-color dragons whose unfolded wings and fiery breath could decorate the entire back of a husky man. He spent half an hour bargaining and finally made a deal with an artist willing to trade a modest tattoo for a tonic to flush the liver. In less than 10 minutes, he had tattooed on the back of his right hand, the hand he used for making bets, the word no in simple and elegant characters. "If you like the tonic, recommend my services to your friends," Dao Chen requested. "If you like my tattoo, do the same," the artist replied. Dao Chen always claimed that the tattoo brought him luck. He went from the shop into the hurly-burly of the market, pushing and elbowing his way through the narrow alleyways, seething with humanity. He did not see a single foreigner, and the market looked exactly like the one in Canton. The noise was like a roaring waterfall, vendors crying the merits of their merchandise and clients bargaining at the top of their lungs in the midst of a deafening riot of caged birds and whimpering animals awaiting their turn for the blade. The pestilence of sweat, live and dead animals, excrement and garbage, spices, opium, street kitchens, all the products and creatures of earth, air, and sea, was so thick you could rub it between your fingers. He saw a woman selling crabs. She took them live from a sack, boiled them a few minutes in a pot of water, the murky consistency of the bottom of the sea, dipped them out with a slotted spoon, doused them with soy sauce, and served them to passing customers on a piece of paper. The woman's hands were covered with warts. Dao Chen negotiated a month's lunches in exchange for treating her skin. "Ah, I see you like crabs very much," she said. "I detest them, but I will eat them as a penitence so I never forget a lesson I must remember forever. And if at the end of a month I am not cured, who will give me back the crabs you have eaten? If at the end of the month you have your warts, my reputation is ruined. Who will buy my medicines then?" Dao smiled. "Very well." And so began Dao's new life in Hong Kong as a free man. In 2 or 3 days, the inflammation faded, and the tattoo appeared as a clean design of blue veins. All that month, as he went from stand to stand in the market offering his professional services, he ate only once a day, always boiled crabs, and lost so much weight he could stick a coin between his ribs. Every creature he put into his mouth, conquering his revulsion, made him smile, thinking of his master, who liked crabs as little as he. The woman's warts disappeared in 26 days, and she gratefully spread the good news around the neighborhood. She offered Dao a second month of crabs if he would cure her cataracts, but he believed he had suffered enough punishment and could grant himself the luxury of never tasting a crab again for the rest of his life. At night, he dragged back to his hole, exhausted, counted his money by candlelight, hid it under a floorboard, and then warmed water on the charcoal brazier to endure his hunger with tea. From time to time, if he began to feel weak in the knees or in his resolve, he bought a scoop of rice, a bit of sugar, or a pipe of opium, which he savored slowly, grateful that there were gifts in the world as dazzling as the consolation of rice, the sweetness of sugar, and the perfect dreams of opium. He spent money on nothing but rent, English classes, shaving his foreskull, and having his change of clothes laundered because he did not want to go about like a beggar. His teacher had always dressed like a mandarin. "Good appearance is a sign of civility. A Zhongyi is not the same as a country healer. The poorer the patient, the richer your clothing should be, out of respect," he had taught his pupil. Gradually, Dao's reputation spread, first among the people in the market and their families, then through the port, where he treated sailors for injuries from brawls, scurvy, venereal cankers, and delirium tremens. After 6 months, Dao Chen had a faithful clientele and had begun to prosper. He moved to a room with a window, furnished it with a large bed, which he would use when he married, a chair, and an English desk. He also bought a few items of clothing. For years he had wanted to dress well. He had made up his mind to learn English because it hadn't taken long to learn where the power lay. A handful of British controlled Hong Kong, made the laws and administered them, and commanded the course of commerce and politics. The Fan Wei lived in exclusive neighborhoods and had dealings with wealthy Chinese, only to do business, always in English. The remaining masses shared the same space and time, but it was as if they did not exist. China's most refined products flowed through Hong Kong directly to the drawing rooms of a Europe fascinated with that centuries-old remote culture. Chinoiserie was the rage. Silk caused a furor in the fashion world. One could not be without graceful bridges with little lanterns and weeping willows, imitating the marvelous secret gardens of Peking. Pagoda roofs ornamented summer houses, and dragon and cherry blossom motifs were repeated ad nauseam in decor. There was no English mansion without an Oriental drawing room, with its Coromandel screen, its collection of porcelains and ivories, its fans embroidered by childish hands in the forbidden stitch, its imperial canaries in carved cages. The ships that carried those treasures to Europe did not return empty. They brought opium from India to sell as contraband and trinkets that devastated small local industries. The Chinese had to compete with the English, Dutch, French, and North Americans to do business in their own country. But the greatest disaster was opium. It had been used in China for centuries as a diversion and for medicinal purposes, but when the English flooded the market, it became an uncontrollable evil. It attacked all sectors of the society, weakening it, causing it to crumble like stale bread. At first, the Chinese looked on the foreigners with scorn and disgust, with the great superiority of those who feel they are the only truly civilized beings in the universe. But in the space of a few years, they learned to respect and fear them. As for the Europeans, they were imbued with the same concept of racial superiority, sure of their role as heralds of civilization in a land of dirty, ugly, weak, noisy, corrupt, and savage people who ate cats and snakes and killed their own children at birth. Few were aware that the Chinese had known writing 1,000 years before they had. While businessmen were imposing a culture of drugs and violence, missionaries were evangelizing. Christianity must be propagated at any cost. It was the one true faith, and the fact that Confucius had lived 1,500 years before Christ was insignificant. The British considered the Chinese barely human, but they intended to save their souls and rewarded conversions with rice. The new Christians would consume their ration of divine bribery and move on to the next church to be converted all over again, amused by the mania of the Fan Wei for preaching their beliefs as if they were unique. For the practical and tolerant Chinese, spirituality was closer to philosophy than to religion. It was a question of ethics, never dogma. Dao Qian took lessons from a compatriot who spoke a soupy English devoid of consonants, but wrote it with absolute correctness. Compared to Chinese characters, the European alphabet had an enchanting simplicity, and after 5 weeks, Dao Qian could read the British newspapers without stumbling over the letters, although every fifth word he had to look up in the dictionary. He spent hours every night studying. He missed his venerable master, who had marked him forever with a thirst for knowledge as persistent as the drunk's thirst for alcohol or the ambitious man's thirst for power. He no longer had his mentor's library or his inexhaustible font of experience. He could not run to him to ask for advice or to discuss a patient's symptoms. He lacked a guide. He felt like an orphan. Since his mentor's death, he had not written or read poetry, had not taken the time to admire nature, to meditate, or to observe the daily rites and ceremonies that had previously enriched his life. He felt filled with noise inside. He longed for the void of silence and solitude his master had taught him to cultivate as life's most precious gift. In the practice of his office, he was learning about the complex nature of humankind, the emotional differences between men and women, the illnesses treatable with remedies and those that also required the magic of the right words. But he had no one to share those experiences with. The dream of buying a wife and having a family was always in his mind, but misty and tenuous, like a beautiful landscape painted on silk. In contrast, his wish to acquire books, to study and find other masters willing to help him along the road of knowledge, was turning into an obsession. This was the state of affairs when Dao Qian met Dr. Ebenezer Hobbs, an English aristocrat, who had none of their usual arrogance and who, unlike other Europeans, was interested in the local color of the city. Dao Qian saw him first in the market, picking through the herbs and potions in a healer's shop. Hobbs knew only 10 words of Mandarin, but he spoke them in such a booming voice and with such conviction that a small crowd, half mocking, half frightened, had gathered around him. He was easy to see from a distance because his head rose far above the Chinese. Dao Chen had never seen a foreigner in this part of the city, so far from the sectors they normally frequented, and he moved closer to observe him better. Hobbs was a young man still, tall and slender, with noble features and large blue eyes. Dao Chen found to his delight that he could translate the Fan Wei's 10 words, that he knew at least that many more in English, and that it might be possible to communicate. He greeted the Englishman with a cordial bow, and the foreigner answered by clumsily imitating his gesture. Both smiled, and then broke out laughing, chorused by the friendly chortles of the spectators. They began an eager dialogue of 20 words, badly pronounced on both sides, and a comic pantomime performed to the growing hilarity of the curious. Soon there was a group sizable enough to block traffic, all weak with laughter, which attracted a British-mounted policeman who ordered the throng to disperse immediately. That was the birth of a solid alliance between the two men. Ebenezer Hobbs was as aware of the limitations of his calling as Dao Chen was of his. The former wanted to learn the secrets of the Eastern medicine he had seen flashes of during his travels through Asia, especially the control of pain through needles inserted at nerve terminals, and the use of combinations of plants and herbs to treat a number of illnesses that in Europe were considered fatal. Dao Chen was fascinated by Western medicine and its aggressive methods of treatment. His was a subtle art of balance and harmony, a slow process of rerouting misdirected energy, preventing illness, and seeking the causes of symptoms. Dao Chen had never practiced surgery, and his knowledge of anatomy, extremely precise in regard to the different pulses and acupuncture points, was limited to what he could see and touch. He knew from memory the anatomical drawings in the library of his former master, but it had never occurred to him to dissect a cadaver. That custom was not accepted in Chinese medicine. His wise master, who had practiced the art of healing for a lifetime, had rarely seen an internal organ and was incapable of a diagnosis if he encountered symptoms that did not fit within the repertory of known ills. Ebenezer Hobbs, on the other hand, dissected cadavers and looked for the cause. That was how one learned. Dao Chen did that for the first time in the basement of the English hospital on a night of typhoons as assistant to Dr. Hobbs, who that same morning had placed his first acupuncture needles to relieve a migraine in the consulting office where Dao Chen attended his patients. In Hong Kong, there were a few missionaries interested in curing the body, as well as converting the souls of their congregation, with whom Dr. Hobbs maintained excellent relations. These evangelists were much closer to the local population than the British physicians of the colony, and they admired the methods of Eastern medicine. They opened the doors of their small hospitals to the Zhongyi. The enthusiasm of Dao Chen and Ebenezer Hobbs for study and experimentation inevitably led to friendship. They met almost in secret, because had their mutual respect and admiration been common knowledge, they would have risked their reputations. Neither European nor Chinese patients admitted that the other race had anything to teach them. As Dao Chen became more comfortable financially, the wish to buy a wife began to occupy his dreams again. On his 22nd birthday, he once again added up his savings, as he often did, and was elated to find that he had enough for a woman with tiny feet and a sweet nature. As he did not have parents to assist him in making his choice as custom demanded, he had to consult an agent. There he was shown portraits of various candidates, but they all looked alike. He found it impossible to deduce a girl's looks, much less her personality, from those modest ink sketches. It was forbidden for him to see the prospective wife with his own eyes, or hear her voice as he would have liked. Neither did he have a female family member to do it for him. One thing was allowed. He could view a girl's feet as she stood behind a curtain, but he had been told that not even that was reliable because the agents often cheated and substituted the golden lilies of a different woman. He had to trust in fate. He came close to leaving the decision to the dice, but the tattoo on his right hand reminded him of past misadventures in games of chance, and he chose to commend the task to the spirits of his mother and his acupuncture master. After going to 5 temples to make offerings, he cast the I Ching sticks, where he read that it was the propitious moment, and so chose his bride. The method did not fail him. When he lifted the red silk kerchief from the face of his new wife, following minimal ceremony since he did not have money for a more splendid wedding, he saw a harmonious face with eyes cast obstinately to the ground. He repeated her name 3 times before she dared look at him with tear-filled eyes, trembling with fright. "I will be good to you," he promised, as emotional as she. From the moment he lifted that red cloth, Dao adored the girl fate had bequeathed him. That love took him by surprise. He had not imagined that such feelings could exist between a man and a woman. He had never heard anyone discuss that kind of love. He had only read vague references in classical literature in which maidens, like landscapes or the moon, were the obligatory subjects of poetic inspiration. Even so, he had believed that in the real world, women were either creatures for working and reproducing, like the peasant women he had grown up among, or else were expensive ornaments. Lin did not fit into either of these categories. She was a mysterious and complex person, capable of disarming him with her irony and challenging him with her questions. She made him laugh like no one else could, invented impossible stories, provoked him with word games. In Lin's presence, everything seemed to be lighted with an irresistible glow. That miraculous discovery of intimacy with another person was the most profound experience of his life. He had had his share of hurried, cock-of-the-walk encounters with prostitutes, but had never had the time and love to know anyone deeply. To open his eyes in the morning and see Lin sleeping beside him made him laugh with happiness, and an instant later tremble with anguish. What if one morning she didn't wake up? The sweet fragrance of her perspiration in their nights of love, the fine line of her eyebrows lifted in an expression of perpetual surprise, the impossible slenderness of her waist, everything about her choked him with tenderness. Oh, and the two of them laughing, that was best of all, the natural joy of that love. His old master's pillow books, which had caused such empty excitement in his adolescence, proved to be a great benefit at the hour of their pleasure. As befitted a young, well-bred virgin, Lin was modest in her everyday behavior, but almost as soon as she lost her fear of her husband, her spontaneous and passionate femininity emerged. In a short time, that eager student learned the 222 manners of making love and, always willing to follow in that headlong race, suggested to her husband that he invent new ones. Fortunately for Dao Chen, the refined knowledge learned in theory in his mentor's library included countless ways of pleasing a woman, and he knew that vigor counted for much less than patience. His fingers were trained to perceive the body's pulses and to locate its most sensitive points blindfolded. His warm, strong hands, expert in soothing his patient's pain, became instruments of infinite pleasure for Lin. Furthermore, he had discovered something the Honorable Zhang Yi had forgotten to teach him, that the best aphrodisiac is love. In bed, they could be so happy that by night, life's problems were erased. But those problems were many, which was evident all too soon. The spirits Dao Chen had invoked to help in his matrimonial choice had done their work to perfection. Lin had bound feet and was as sweet and timid as a squirrel. But Dao Chen had not thought to ask that his wife also be strong and healthy. The same woman who seemed inexhaustible at night was, during the day, transformed into an invalid. She could walk no farther than a block or two on her tiny, mutilated feet. It is true that when she walked, she moved with the soft delicacy of a reed in the breeze, as the ancient acupuncture master had written in one of his poems. But it was no less true that a short trip to the market to buy a cabbage for dinner was true torment to her golden lilies. She never complained aloud, but he had only to see her perspire and bite her lips to guess the effort of every step. She also had weak lungs. She breathed with the sharp whistle of the goldfinch, lived through the rainy season with a runny nose, and in the dry season choked because the warm air seemed to pass no farther than her lips. Neither her husband's herbs nor the tonics of his friend the English doctor could help her. When she became pregnant, she grew worse, for her fragile build could barely support the weight of the child. In the fourth month, she stopped going out altogether and sat listlessly before the window, watching life passing in the street. Dao Qian hired two servant girls to take over the domestic chores and stay with her, because he feared that Lin would die in his absence. He doubled his working hours and, for the first time, harassed his patients to pay, which filled him with shame. He could feel the critical gaze of his master reminding him of the duty to serve without expecting a return, for he who knows most has the greatest obligation toward humanity. He could not, nevertheless, work for free or in exchange of favors as he had before. He needed every cent to keep Lin comfortable. By then, he had rented the second floor of an old house where he installed his wife with refinements that neither of them had known before, but he wasn't satisfied. It was in his mind to get her a house with a garden. That way she would have beauty and pure air. His friend Ebenezer Hobbs told him, since Dao himself refused to see the evidence, that Lin's tuberculosis was very advanced and that there was no garden capable of curing her. Instead of working from dawn to midnight to buy her silk dresses and beautiful furniture, stay with her as much as possible, Dr. Qian. You must enjoy her while you have her, Hobbs counseled. The two physicians agreed, each from the perspective of his own experience, that the birth would be a test of fire for Lin. Neither was an expert on this subject, for in Europe as well as China, births were in the hands of midwives, but the men decided to study in that area. Neither Hobbs nor Dao Qian had any confidence in the expertise of some low-course woman, which was how they regarded all the women who practiced midwifery. They had watched them work with their revolting hands, their witchery, and their brutal methods for separating the baby from the mother, and were determined to spare Lin that miserable experience. She, however, did not want to give birth in the presence of the two men, especially when one of them was a Fan Wei with pale eyes, someone who could not even speak the language of civilized beings. She begged her husband to go to the neighborhood midwife, because the most elementary decency prohibited her from spreading her legs before a foreign devil. But this time Dao Qian, always ready to please her, was inflexible. Finally, they agreed that he personally would attend her, while Ebenezer Hobbs stayed in the next room to lend verbal support should it be needed. The first indication of the coming birth was an asthma attack that nearly cost Lin her life. Her efforts to breathe were enmeshed with those of her womb to expel the infant, and both Dao Qian, with all his love and science, and Ebenezer Hobbs, with his medical texts, were helpless to know what to do. 10 hours later, when the moans of the mother had been reduced to the harsh gurgling of someone drowning, and the baby gave no signs of being born, Dao Qian raced out to look for the midwife, and despite his revulsion, practically dragged her home. As Qian and Hobbs had feared, the woman was a foul-smelling old drab with whom it was impossible to exchange the least medical information, because her knowledge came not from science, but from long experience and ancient instinct. She began by shoving the two men aside, forbidding them even to put their heads through the curtains that separated the two rooms. Dao Qian never learned what happened behind that barrier, but he felt better when he heard Lin breathing without choking and screaming. In the following hours, while Ebenezer Hobbs slept exhausted in a chair, and Dao Qian desperately consulted the spirit of his master, Lin brought a lifeless girl child into the world. As the baby was female, neither the midwife nor the father made any great effort to revive her, though both gave themselves to the task of saving the mother, who was losing what little strength she had at the rate the blood flowed from between her legs. Lin scarcely mourned the death of the baby girl, as if she knew she would not live long enough to have raised her. Slowly she recovered from the difficult delivery, and for a while tried to be the happy companion of their nighttime game. With the same discipline she had used to mask the pain of her feet, she pretended enthusiasm for her husband's passionate embraces. "Sex is a voyage, a sacred voyage," she had often said to him, but now she lacked the spirit to accompany him. Dao Qian so longed for that love that one by one he ignored the telltale signs and kept believing to the end that Lin was the same as she had been. For years he had dreamed of sons, but now all he wanted was to protect his wife from another pregnancy. His feelings for Lynn had become a veneration that he could confess only to her. He thought that no one could understand such consuming love for a woman, that no one knew Lynn as he did, that no one knew the light she brought to his life. I am happy, he kept repeating to drive away the dark premonitions that assaulted him when he dropped his guard. But he was not happy. He didn't laugh now with the same lightheartedness, and when he was with Lynn, he took little pleasure from it, except in some perfect moments of carnal intimacy, because he was watching her every minute, worried, always thinking of her health, aware of her fragility, measuring the rhythm of her breathing. He came to despise her golden lilies, which in the early days of their marriage he had kissed with sublime passion. Ebenezer Hobbs wanted Lynn to take long outings in the open air to strengthen her lungs and pique her appetite, but she could barely take 10 steps without faltering. Dow could not stay beside his wife every minute, as Hobbs suggested, because he had to provide for them. Each instant he was away from her seemed life wasted in unhappiness, time stolen from love. He placed all his experience with herbs at the service of his beloved, all the knowledge he had acquired over years of practicing medicine. But 1 year after the birth, Lynn had become a shadow of the happy girl she had once been. Her husband kept trying to make her laugh, but their laughter rang false to them both. One day, Lynn could not get out of bed. She lay choking, her strength draining away, coughing blood and trying to breathe. She refused to eat anything except spoonfuls of a clear soup because the effort exhausted her. She slept in spurts during the few moments she wasn't coughing. Dao Chen calculated that for 6 weeks her breathing had been a liquid rasping, as if she were underwater. When he picked her up in his arms, he could tell how much weight she was losing, and his heart shrank with terror. He had watched her suffer so much that her death should have come as a relief. But the fateful morning when he awakened, embracing Lynn's icy body, he thought he too would die. A long and terrible scream born from the depths of the earth, like the roar of a volcano, shook the house and waked everyone in the vicinity. The neighbors came and kicked down the door to find him naked in the middle of the room, holding his wife in his arms and howling. They had to pry her body from his arms and hold him down until Ebenezer Hobbs arrived and made him drink a dose of laudanum capable of felling a lion. Dao Chen sank into widowerhood with total despair. He made an altar with the portrait of Lynn and some of her belongings and spent hours staring at it in desolation. He stopped seeing his patients or sharing studies and research with Ebenezer Hobbs, activities on which their friendship was based. He was repelled by the advice of the Englishman, who maintained that what he needed was a bit of the hair of the dog, and that the best way to get over his grief was to visit the brothels in the port, where he could choose all the women he wanted with deformed feet, Hobbs' term for golden lilies. How could his friend suggest such an abhorrent idea? The woman didn't live who could replace Lynn. He would never love another, of that Dao Chen was sure. All he accepted from Hobbs during that period were his generous bottles of whiskey. For weeks he lived in a haze of alcohol. Gradually his money ran out, and he had to sell or pawn his possessions, until the day came that he couldn't pay his rent and had to move to a cheap hotel. Then he remembered that he was a Zhong Yi and began to work again, although he barely managed, unshaven, dirty, the hair in his queue flying. Since he had a good reputation, his patients put up with his unkempt appearance and drunken errors with resignation, but gradually they stopped coming to see him. And Ebenezer Hobbs stopped calling on him to treat difficult cases because he had lost confidence in Dow's judgment. Until that time, they had complemented each other well. The Englishman was, for the first time, able to perform surgery boldly, thanks to the powerful drugs and golden needles that soothed pain, reduced hemorrhaging, and shortened the time of healing. And the Chinese physician had learned to use the scalpel and other techniques of European science. But with his trembling hands and eyes clouded by intoxication and tears, Dao Chen represented a danger more than he did support and assistance. In the spring of 1847, Dao Chen's destiny took a sudden turn, as it had once or twice before in his life. As he lost his regular patients and the rumors spread of his downhill course as a physician, he had to concentrate more in the poorest sections of the port, where no one asked for references. The cases were routine, contusions and knife and bullet wounds. One night, Dao Chen was called to an emergency in a tavern to stitch a sailor's injuries following a royal free-for-all. They led him to the back of the room where a man was lying unconscious, his head split open like a watermelon. His opponent, a gigantic Norwegian, had picked up a heavy wood table and used it as a club to defend himself against his attackers, a gang of Chinese intending to beat him to a pulp. They had rushed the Norwegian and would have made mincemeat out of him had not several Scandinavian sailors drinking at the same bar come to his rescue. And what had begun as an argument among drunken gamblers turned into a racial brawl. By the time Dao Chen arrived, anyone who could walk had long since disappeared. The Norwegian, uninjured, was escorted to his ship by two English policemen, and the only ones left in sight were the tavern keeper, the dying victim, and the ship's pilot, who had worked out an arrangement to send the police on their way. Had the victim been European, he would have been taken to the British hospital. But since he was Asian, the port authorities were not putting themselves out too much. Dao Chen took one look and could see that nothing could be done for that poor devil, whose skull was cracked wide open and his brain spilling out. This he explained to the pilot, a bearded, heavy-set Englishman. "Damn chink, can't you stop the blood and sew him up?" he demanded. "With his head like that, why sew him up? He has a right to die in peace." "He can't die. My ship sails at dawn, and I need this man on board. He's my cook." "Very regrettable," Dao Chen replied with a courteous bow of his head, trying to hide his disgust at the Fan Wei's insensitivity. The pilot ordered a bottle of gin and invited Dao Chen to have a drink with him. If the cook was beyond consolation, they might as well lift a glass in his name, he said, so his fucking ghost, a pox on him, didn't come and pull their toes at night. They sat down a few feet from the dying man to take their time getting drunk. Occasionally, Dao Chen bent down to take the man's pulse, calculating that he couldn't have more than a couple of minutes longer to live. But the man was slower to die than he thought. The Zhongyi was oblivious to how the Englishman was pouring him drink after drink while barely downing his. Soon Dao felt so dizzy he couldn't remember what he was doing in that place anyway. And an hour later, when his patient twice shuddered violently and actually died, Dao Chen missed it because he had rolled to the floor unconscious. He waked to the blinding light of midday, opened his eyes, squinting, and as soon as he could raise his head, saw nothing but sky and water all around him. It took him quite a while to realize that he was lying face up on a large coil of rope on the deck of a ship. The pounding of the waves against the hull beat in his head like a clanging bell. He thought he heard voices and shouting, but he wasn't sure of anything. He could just as easily have been in hell. He struggled to his knees and crawled forward a couple of meters, but was overcome by nausea and collapsed back onto the deck. A few minutes later, he felt the shock of a pail of cold water splash over his head and heard a voice speaking to him in Cantonese. He looked up and saw a beardless, sympathetic face greeting him with a wide smile from which half the teeth were missing. A second pail of seawater shook him from his stupor. The young Chinese man, who had so solicitously dumped water on him, squatted down beside him, laughing loudly and slapping his thighs as if Dao's pathetic condition were irresistibly funny. "Where am I?" Dao Chen managed to stammer. "Welcome aboard the Liberty. We are sailing west, I think. But I don't want to go anywhere. I have to get off immediately." New guffaws met this statement. When finally the man could control his hilarity, he explained to Dao that he had been shanghaied, just as he himself had been a couple of months earlier. Dao Chen felt he was going to faint. He knew what that meant. If there weren't enough men to fill out a crew, the captain or pilot fell back on stopgap measures. Getting some unwary bar patron drunk, even knocking him out, and signing him on against his will. Life at sea was rough and paid badly. Accidents, malnutrition, and illness cut into the ranks. On each voyage, one or more sailors died, and their bodies ended up on the ocean floor, with no one to give them another thought. Added to that, the captains tended to be despots who did not have to give an accounting to anyone, and who punished the slightest offense with a lashing. In Shanghai, it was so bad that they'd had to reach a gentleman's agreement among captains to put an end to kidnapping free men and stealing each other's crew. Before the accord, every time a sailor came into port to have a few drinks, he ran the risk of waking up on a different ship. The pilot of the Liberty had decided to replace his dead cook with Dao Chen. In his eyes, all the yellow race were alike. One was as good as the next. So after getting Dao drunk, he had him hauled aboard. Before Dao came to, the pilot had stamped his thumbprint on a contract that signed him up for 2 years. Slowly, the magnitude of what had happened sank into Dao Chen's soggy brain. The idea of rebelling was never a consideration. That would be suicide. But he intended to desert the minute they touched land, wherever on the planet that might be. The young Asian helped Dao get to his feet and wash his face, then led him below decks to where the berths and hammocks were lined up. He assigned Dao a bunk and a box to store his gear in. Dao Chen feared he'd lost everything, but found the case containing his medical instruments on the wood planks that would be his bed. The pilot had had the good sense to save it. Lin's portrait, however, was left behind on its altar. He realized with horror that the spirit of his wife might not be able to locate him in the middle of the ocean. The first few days at sea were torture. At times he was tempted by the thought of jumping overboard and ending his suffering once and for all. Almost as soon as he could stay on his feet, he was assigned to the rudimentary galley, where the pots hung from hooks, clanging together with every toss of the waves, making a deafening racket. The fresh provisions brought aboard in Hong Kong were rapidly depleted, and soon there was nothing but fish, salted meat, beans, sugar, lard, wormy flour, and biscuits so stale that sometimes they had to be hacked into pieces. Every bite of food was smothered in soy sauce. Each sailor had a pint of liquor per day to drown his sorrows and rinse out his mouth, because inflamed gums were one of the problems of life at sea. For the captain's table, Dao Chen had eggs and English marmalade, which he had been directed to protect with his life. Rations were calculated to last the trip if no unusual difficulties arose, such as storms that blew them off course or lying becalmed, complemented with fresh fish netted along the way. Great culinary skill was not expected of Dao Chen. His role was to dole out the food, liquor, and fresh water assigned to each man, and to do battle against spoilage and rats. He also had a normal share of swabbing and sailing chores, like any other sailor. After a week, he began to enjoy the fresh air, the hard work, and the company of those men who came from the four corners of the earth, each with his stories, his nostalgia, and his skills. During breaks from work, they would play instruments and tell tales of the phantoms of the waves and the exotic women in distant ports. The crew came from many places, from many tongues and customs, but they were united by something that resembled friendship. Isolation and the knowledge that they needed each other made comrades of men who on dry land would not have given each other a second look. Dao Chen began to laugh again, as he hadn't laughed since Lin's illness. One morning, the pilot called him to introduce him to Captain John Summers, whom Dao had seen only from a distance on the bridge. He found himself facing a tall, darkly bearded, steely-eyed man, tanned by the winds of many latitudes. He spoke to Dao through the pilot, who knew a little Cantonese, but Dao replied in his book English with the affected aristocratic accent he had learned from Ebenezer Hobbs.
"Mr. Oglesby tells me that you're some kind of healer."
"I am a Zhongyi, a physician."
"Physician? What do you mean, physician?"
"Chinese medicine is several centuries older than the English, Captain."
Dao Chen laughed gently, using his friend Ebenezer Hobbs' exact words. Captain Summers raised his eyebrows, angered by the lowly crew member's insolence, but was disarmed by the truth of the statement. He laughed with good nature.
"Well, we'll see. Mr. Oglesby, pour us 3 glasses of brandy. We're going to drink a toast to our doctor here. This is a rare luxury. For the first time, we're carrying our own physician on board."
Dao Chen did not affect his plan to desert in the first port reached by the Liberty because he didn't know where to go. To return to his life as a miserable widower in Hong Kong made as little sense as to go on sailing. Here or there, it was all the same. And at least as a seaman, he would travel and learn the ways medicine was practiced in other parts of the world. The one thing that really tormented him was that in all that wandering across the waves, Lin might not be able to find him, however much he screamed her name to the winds. In the first port, he went ashore, like the others, with a 6-hour pass. But instead of spending that time in taverns, following the captain's orders, he dove into the market in search of spices and medicinal plants. "Now that we have a doctor, we'll need remedies," he'd said. He gave Dao a pouch with a specified sum of coins and warned him that if he gave a thought to escaping or tricking him, he would hunt him down and slit his throat with his own hands, for the man hadn't been born who could cheat him and get away with it. "Is that clear, Chinaman?"
"It is clear, Englishman."
"You address me as sir."
"Yes, sir," Dao Chen replied, looking down, because he was learning not to look white men in the face.
His first surprise had been to discover that China was not the absolute center of the universe. There were other cultures, more barbaric, that was true, but much more powerful. He had not suspected that the British controlled a large part of the globe. Just as he had never suspected that other Fanwei were masters of far-reaching colonies in distant lands spread across 4 continents, as Captain John Summers went to the trouble of explaining to him the day that Dao pulled his infected tooth as they were sailing off the coast of Africa. He accomplished that operation cleanly and almost painlessly, thanks to a combination of his gold needles in the captain's temples and a paste of cloves and eucalyptus applied to his gums. When it was over, and the relieved and grateful patient was polishing off his bottle of liquor, Dao Chen dared ask where they were going. It was upsetting to him to travel blindly, the blurred horizon between sea and an infinite sky the only reference.
"We're sailing in the direction of Europe, but for us, nothing changes. We are seafarers, always on water. Do you want to go back home?"
"No, sir."
"Do you have a family somewhere?"
"No, sir."
"Then it's the same to you whether we're going north or south, east or west, isn't that true?"
"Yes, but I like to know where I am."
"Why is that?"
"Because if I fall overboard or the ship sinks, my spirit will need to know where it is in order to find its way back to China. If not, it will wander around aimlessly. The gates to heaven are in China."
"Where did you get that daft idea?" the captain said, laughing. "So, in order to get to paradise, you have to die in China. Take a look at the map, man. Your country is the largest, that's true, but there's a lot of the world outside China. Here is England. It is only a small island, but if you add our colonies, you will see that we are masters of more than half the globe."
"How did you do that?"
"The same way we did it in Hong Kong, with war and deceit. Let's say that it's a blend of naval power, greed, and discipline. We are not superior, we're crueler and greedier. I'm not particularly proud of being English, and after you've travelled as much as I have, you won't be proud of being Chinese either."
During the next 2 years, Dao Chen stepped on terra firma only 3 times, one of which was in England. He lost himself among the huge throngs in the port and walked through the streets of London looking at new things with the eyes of an enchanted child. The Fan Wei were filled with surprises. On the one hand, they lacked any touch of refinement and behaved like savages. But on the other, they were capable of amazing inventiveness. He confirmed that in their own country, the English suffered the same arrogance and bad manners they exhibited in Hong Kong. They had no respect for him and knew nothing of courtesy or etiquette. He tried to buy an ale, but they pushed him out of the inn. "No yellow dogs allowed in here," they told him. Soon he joined some other Asian sailors, and they found a place run by an elderly Chinese man where they could eat, drink, and smoke in peace. Listening to the stories the other men told, Dao calculated how much he still had to learn, and decided that first would be how to use his fists and his knife. Knowledge is not of much use if you can't defend yourself. The wise acupuncture master had also forgotten to teach him that fundamental principle. In February of 1849, the Liberty moored in Valparaiso. The next day, Captain John Summers called Dow to his cabin and handed him a letter.
"This was given to me in the port. It's for you, and it's from England."
Dow Chen took the envelope, blushed, and a huge smile illuminated his face.
"Don't tell me it's a love letter," the captain joked.
"Better than that," Dow answered, slipping it between his shirt and his skin. The letter could only be from his friend Ebenezer Hobbs, the first he had received in the 2 years he had been at sea.
"You've done a good job, Chen."
"I thought, sir, you did not like my cooking," Dao Chen said and smiled.
"As a cook, you're a disaster, but you know your medicine. In 2 years' time, I've not lost a single man, and none of the crew has scurvy. Do you know what that means?"
"Good fortune."
"Your contract is up today. I suppose I could get you drunk and make you sign an extension. I might do that to another man, but I owe you some favors, and I pay my debts. Do you want to go on with me? I will raise your wages."
"Where are you going?"
"To California, but I'm going to leave this ship. I've been offered a steamship, an opportunity I've been waiting a long time for. I would like you to come with me."
Dao Chen had heard of steamships and had a horror of them. The idea of enormous boilers filled with red-hot water to produce steam and power infernal machinery could have occurred only to people always in a hurry. Wasn't it far better to travel to the rhythm of the winds and currents? Why challenge nature? He had heard rumors of boilers that exploded at sea, cooking the crew alive. Bits of human flesh, parboiled like shrimp, shooting off in all directions to become fish food, while the souls of those wretches, fragmented in the force of the explosion and swirling steam, could never rejoin their ancestors. Dao Chen clearly remembered how his young sister had looked after the pot of hot water emptied over her, as clearly as he remembered her horrible moans of pain and her convulsions as she died. He was not prepared to run that kind of risk. Neither was he overly tempted by the gold in California, although he had heard it lay about on the ground like rocks. He did not owe John Summers anything. The captain was a little more tolerant than most of the Fanway, and he treated his crew with a certain even-handedness, but he was not his friend, and never would be. "No, thank you, sir."
"Don't you want to see California? You can get rich in a trice and go back to China a man of parts."
"Yes, but on a sailing ship."
"Why is that? Steamships are more modern and much faster."
Dao Chen did not try to explain his reasons. He stood silent, staring at the deck, cap in hand, while the captain finished drinking his whiskey.
"I can't force you," Summers said finally. "I will give you a letter of recommendation to my friend Vincent Katz, who captains the brigantine Amelia. She's also sailing to California in the next few days. Katz is a rather strange Dutchman, very strict and very religious, but he is a good man and a good sailor. Your trip will be slower than mine, but perhaps we'll see one another in San Francisco. And if you regret your decision, you can always come back to work with me."
Captain John Summers and Dao Chen shook hands for the first time. The Voyage. Curled in her burrow in the storeroom, Eliza began to die. To the darkness and the sensation of being walled up in life was added the odor, a foul blend of the contents of bales and boxes, barrels of salted fish, and deposits of ocean extracts crusted on the old planks of the ship. Her acute sense of smell, so useful for getting through the world with closed eyes, had become an instrument of torture. Her only company was a strange tricolored cat buried like her in the hold and there to keep it free of rats. Dao Chen assured her that she would get used to the stench and to being closed up, because in times of necessity, the body adapts to nearly everything. He added that the voyage would be a long one and that she could not come out in the fresh air, so she would be better off not to think if she didn't want to go mad. She would have water and food, he promised. He would take care of that when he could come down to the hold without arousing suspicion.
The ship was small, but it was crowded, and it would be easy to find reasons to slip down there.
Thank you. When we reach California, I will give you the turquoise brooch.
Keep it. You already paid me. You will need it.
Why are you going to California?
To be married.
My sweetheart's name is Joaquin.
He was infected by gold fever and went off to make his fortune. He said he would be back, but I can't wait for that.
Almost as soon as the ship left the bay of Valparaiso and was in open water, Eliza began to rave. For hours she lay in darkness in her own filth like an animal, so ill that she didn't remember where she was or why. Finally, the door of the wooden hatch opened and Dao Qian appeared, lighted by the flame of a candle stub and carrying a plate of food. He needed only one look to realize that the girl would not be able to get anything down. He gave the meal to the cat and went back to look for a pail of water so he could clean her up. He began by giving her strong ginger tea to drink and inserting a dozen of his golden needles until her stomach was settled. Eliza paid little attention when he removed all her clothing, washed her delicately with seawater, rinsed her with a cup of fresh water, and massaged her from head to foot with the balm recommended for malarial fevers. Minutes later, she was asleep, wrapped in her Castile mantle with the cat at her feet, while Dao Qian was up on deck washing her clothes in the sea, trying not to call attention, although the sailors were resting at that hour. The new passengers were as seasick as Eliza, to the indifference of those from Europe who had been traveling for 3 months and had passed that test. In the following days, while the new passengers on the Amelia grew accustomed to the battering of the waves and established the routines they would follow for the rest of the journey, Eliza was growing steadily sicker in the depths of the ship. Dao Qian went down as often as he could to take her water and try to calm her nausea, surprised that instead of diminishing, her discomfort was increasing by the hour. He tried to give her relief with the known treatments for such cases and with others he improvised, but Eliza could keep almost nothing in her stomach and was getting dehydrated. He prepared water with salt and sugar, and with infinite patience gave it to her by spoonfuls. But 2 weeks went by without any apparent improvement, and the moment came when the girl's skin hung as loose as strips of parchment, and she could no longer get up to do the exercises Dao insisted on. "If you don't move, your body will swell and your mind will grow dark," he kept telling her. The ship called briefly in the ports of Coquimbo, Caldera, Antofagasta, Iquique, and Arica, and in each he tried to convince Eliza to get off and find a way to go back home, because he could see her growing weaker and weaker, and he was afraid. They had left the port of Callao behind them when Eliza's condition took a lethal turn. In the market, Dao Qian had found a supply of coca leaves, whose medicinal properties he knew well, and 3 live hens he intended to hide and kill one by one, for the sick girl needed something more appetizing than their meager ship's rations. He cooked the first hen in a broth rich with fresh ginger and went below ready to feed Eliza the soup if he had to force it down her throat. He lighted a whale oil lamp, picked his way through the cargo, and approached the rat hole of his patient, who was lying with her eyes closed and did not seem to know he was there. Beneath her spread a large pool of blood. The Zhongyi grunted and bent over her, fearing that the pitiful creature had found a way to commit suicide. He couldn't blame her. In similar circumstances, he would have done the same, he thought. He lifted her nightdress, but saw no visible wound, and when he touched her, he realized she was still alive. He shook her until her eyes opened.
"I am pregnant," she admitted finally in a thread of a voice.
Dao Qian clapped his hands to his head, lost in a litany of laments in the dialect of his native village, a tongue he had not spoken in 15 years. Had he known, he would never have helped her. What was she thinking to leave for California pregnant? She was crazy, just what he needed, a miscarriage. If she died, he was lost. What kind of mess had he gotten himself into? Was he stupid? Why hadn't he guessed the reason for her haste in leaving Chile? He added a few oaths and curses in English, but she was again unconscious and far beyond any reproach. He held her in his arms, rocking her as he would a child, as his rage melted into overwhelming compassion. For an instant, it occurred to him to go to Captain Katz and confess the whole matter, but he could not predict his reaction. That Dutch Lutheran, who treated the women on board as if they were carriers of the plague, would undoubtedly be furious when he learned that he had another woman aboard, this one a stowaway, and pregnant and half dead in the bargain. And what punishment would he save for Dao Qian? No, he couldn't say a word to anyone. His only salvation would be to wait until Eliza passed on, if that was her karma, and then throw her body overboard along with the bags of garbage from the kitchen. The most he could do for her, if he saw her suffering too much, would be to help her die with dignity. He was just leaving when he sensed a strange presence on his skin. Frightened, he lifted the lamp and with absolute clarity saw in the circle of the trembling flame his adored Lin watching him from a short distance away, and on her translucid face that teasing expression that was her greatest charm. She was wearing her green silk dress with the gold embroidery, the one she saved for great occasions, and her hair was pulled back into a simple bun, secured with ivory picks, and with a fresh peony over each ear. That was how he had seen her for the last time, when the neighbor women had dressed her for the funeral ceremony. So real was the apparition of his wife there in the hold that he was thrown into a panic. Spirits, however good in life, tended to treat mortals very cruelly. He rushed toward the ladder, but Lin blocked the way. Dao Qian fell to his knees, trembling, clutching the lamp, his one tie with reality. He attempted a prayer to exorcise devils in case they had taken Lin's form to confuse him, but he could not remember the words, and only a long moan of love for her and nostalgia for the past came from his lips. Then Lin bent down to him with her unforgettable delicacy, so close that had he dared he could have kissed her, and whispered that she had not come so far to frighten him, but to remind him of the duties of an honorable physician. She herself had nearly bled to death after the birth of her daughter, and he had been able to save her. Why did he not do the same for this young woman? What had happened to her beloved Dao? Had he perhaps lost his kind heart and turned into a cockroach? A premature death was not Eliza's karma, she assured him. If a woman is prepared to travel the world buried in a nightmarish hole in order to find her man, it is because she has much ki. You must help her, Dao. If she dies without seeing her lover, she will never be at peace, and her ghost will pursue you forever, Lin warned him before she faded away. Wait, Dao begged, reaching out to stop her, but his fingers closed on air. Dao Qian lay prostrate on the floor for a long time, struggling to recapture his reason, until his crazed heart stopped galloping and the faint scent of Lin had evaporated from the hold. Don't go, don't go, he repeated 1,000 times, sick with love. Finally, he was able to get to his feet, open the hatch, and go out to the fresh air. It was a warm night. The Pacific Ocean was gleaming like silver in the moonlight, and a light breeze bellied the worn sails of the Amelia. Many passengers had already gone to bed or were playing cards in their cabins. Others had hung their hammocks to pass the night amid the chaos of machines, harnesses, and boxes that covered the decks. And some were amusing themselves at the stern, watching the playful dolphins in the foam of the wake. Dao Qian looked up toward the enormous dome of the sky with gratitude. For the first time since her death, Lin had visited him openly. Before beginning his life as a sailor, he had seen her nearby from time to time, especially when he was deep in meditation. But then it had been easy to confuse the tentative presence of her spirit with his widower's longing. Lin tended to touch him lightly with her fine fingers as she passed, but he would be left with the doubt of whether it was really she or just a figment of his tormented soul. Moments earlier in the hold, however, he had had no doubts. Lin's face had been as radiant and clear as the moon over that sea. He felt her with him and was content, as in those long-ago nights when she nestled in his arms after they made love. Dao Qian went to the crew's quarters where he had a narrow wood bunk, far from what little ventilation filtered through the hatch. It was impossible to sleep there in the thick air and funk from the sleeping men,
but he hadn't had to do that since leaving Valparaiso, because the summer weather allowed him to stretch out on the deck. He looked for his trunk, nailed to the floor to secure it in the tossing of the ship, removed the key from around his neck, opened the padlock, and took out a vial of laudanum. Then he quietly drew a double ration of fresh water and went to get rags from the kitchen, which would do for lack of something better. He was on his way back to the hold when he was stopped by a hand on his arm. He turned in surprise and saw one of the Chilean women who, defying the captain's explicit order to stay out of sight after sunset, had come out to entice clients. He recognized her immediately. Of all the women on board, Azucena Placeres was the most sympathetic and most outgoing. During the first days, she was the only one willing to help seasick passengers, and had also dutifully nursed a young sailor who had fallen from the mast and broken his arm. She had won the respect even of the stern Captain Katz, who, from that time, had looked the other way when she broke the rules. Azucena offered her services as a nurse for free, but if anyone made so bold as to lay a hand on her firm flesh, he had to pay in coin of the realm, because, as she said, there was no reason to confuse a good heart with stupidity. "This is my only capital," she would say, jauntily slapping herself on the buttocks, "and if I'm not careful with it, I'll screw up for real." Azucena Placeres spoke to Dow in four words that can be understood in any language: chocolate, coffee, tobacco, and brandy. As always, when she met him, she expressed in graphic sign language her wish to exchange any of those luxuries for her favors, but the Zhongyi pushed her aside and kept on his way. For a good part of the night, Dao Chen sat beside the feverish Eliza. He worked over her weakened body with the limited resources of his bag, his long experience, and a wavering tenderness until she expelled a bloody little mollusk. Dao Chen examined it in the lamplight and determined that, without the slightest doubt, it was a 5 or 6 week fetus and was whole. To clean out her womb, he inserted his needles in the girl's arms and legs, provoking strong contractions. When he was sure of the results, he sighed with relief. All that remained was to ask Lin to do her part to prevent infection. Until that night, he had thought of Eliza as a business arrangement, and he had the pearl necklace in the bottom of his trunk to prove it. She was just a stranger, a girl for whom he had no particular feelings, a Fan Wei with big feet and an aggressive temperament, who hadn't had any luck in getting a husband since, it was easy to see. She had no inclination to please or serve a man. Now, with the misfortune of this miscarriage, she would never marry. Not even her lover, who had already abandoned her once anyway, would want her for a wife, in the unlikely event that she ever found him. He had to admit that for a foreigner, Eliza was not all that ugly. At least there was a slightly oriental air about her almond eyes and her hair, as long, black, and shiny as the proud tail of an imperial horse. If she had had that diabolical yellow or red hair, like so many women he had seen since leaving China, he might never have gone near her. However, neither her looks nor her strong character would help her now. Her bad luck was cast. There was no hope for her. She would end up walking the streets in California. He had been with many such women in Canton and Hong Kong. He owed a large part of his medical knowledge to the years he had practiced on the bodies of those luckless girls, abused by beatings, sickness, and drugs. Several times during that long night, he asked himself whether it wouldn't be more noble to let her die, despite Lin's instructions, and save her from a horrible fate. But she had paid him in advance, and he should carry out his part of the deal, he told himself. No, that wasn't the only reason, he concluded, since from the beginning he had questioned his own motives for helping this girl stow away. The risk was enormous. He wasn't sure he had committed such a foolish act merely for the value of the pearls. Something in Eliza's valiant determination had moved him. Something about the fragility of her body and the bold love she professed for her lover reminded him of Lin. Finally, near dawn, Eliza stopped bleeding. She was delirious with fever and shivering despite the unbearable heat of the hold, but her pulse was steadier and she was breathing calmly in her sleep.
She was not, however, out of danger. Dao Chen wanted to stay with her and watch her, but he calculated that soon the bell would sound to summon him to his watch. He dragged himself up the companionway, fell face down on the planks of the deck, and slept like a baby until a friendly shove from the foot of another sailor woke him to his duties. He plunged his head into a pail of seawater to wash the sleep from his eyes and, still in a stupor, went to the kitchen to boil the oatmeal that constituted breakfast. Everyone ate it without comment, even the sober Captain Katz, except for the Chileans, who chorused a protest, despite being better provided for than anyone, having been the latest to come aboard. Other passengers had polished off their provisions of tobacco, alcohol, and sweets in insufferable months at sea before reaching Valparaiso. Word had spread that some of the Chileans were aristocrats, and that was why they didn't know how to wash their own underdrawers or boil water for tea. The ones traveling in first class had brought servants who could work for them in the gold mines, because the concept of dirtying their hands personally had never crossed their minds. Others paid the sailors to wait on them, since the women, in a block, refused. They could earn 10 times the price by welcoming their countrymen for 10 minutes in the privacy of the women's room, so there was no reason to spend 2 hours washing dirty laundry. The crew and the rest of the passengers mocked those spoiled sissies, but never to their faces. The Chileans had good manners, they seemed timid enough, and made a great show of courtesy and gentlemanliness, but it took only the tiniest spark to inflame their arrogance. Dao Chen tried to avoid them. They did not mask their scorn for him, or for the 2 Negro passengers who boarded the ship in Brazil. They had paid for their passage, but they were the only ones who were not given a cabin or allowed to eat at table with the others. Dao preferred the 5 humble Chilean women, with their solid, practical sense, their unflagging good humor, and the maternal feelings that flowered in times of emergency. He finished his watch like a sleepwalker, his thoughts on Eliza, but couldn't find a free minute to see her until that night. At mid-morning, the sailors had caught an enormous shark, which died on deck, thrashing wickedly in its death throes, while no one dared to go near enough to club it. It fell to Dao Chen, in his role as cook, to supervise the task of skinning it, chopping it into pieces, cooking part of the meat and salting the rest, while the sailors washed the blood from the deck and the passengers celebrated the horrific spectacle with the last remaining bottles of champagne, anticipating a feast at dinner. Dao kept the heart for Eliza's soup and the fins to dry. They would be worth a fortune in the aphrodisiac market. As the hours went by and the chores involving the shark, Dao Chen imagined Eliza dead in the heart of the ship. He felt a surge of happiness when at last he went down and found that she was still alive and looking better. The hemorrhaging had stopped, the jug of water was empty, and everything indicated that there had been moments of lucidity during that long day. Briefly, he thanked Lin for her help. The girl struggled to open her eyes. Her lips were dry and her face flushed with fever. He helped her to her feet and fed her a strong broth of tang kuei to build up her blood. When he was sure she would keep it on her stomach, he gave her a few sips of fresh milk, which she drank avidly. Invigorated, she announced that she was hungry and asked for more. The cows they were carrying on board, unused to the sea, were producing very little. Nothing but bones, there was already talk of slaughtering them. Dao Chen found the idea of drinking milk repulsive, but his friend Ebenezer Hobbs had advised him of its properties for replenishing lost blood. If Hobbs recommended it in the diet of someone gravely wounded, it should have the same effect in this instance, Dao decided.
Am I going to die, Dao?
Not yet, he smiled and patted Eliza's head.
How long before we reach California?
A long time. Don't think about that. Now you must urinate.
No, please,
she protested.
Why not? You must.
In front of you.
I am a Zhong Yi. You cannot feel embarrassed with me. I have seen everything there is to see of your body.
I can't move. I can't survive this voyage, Dao. I would rather die,
Eliza sobbed, steadying herself on him as she sat on the pot.
Be brave, girl.
Lin says you have much ki, and you have not come this far to die in mid-journey.
Who says that?
Not important.